wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, the Portland metro area's community-powered radio station. It's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning, the Old Mole Collective of artists, agitators, and scholars tunnel underground to unearth the larger significance behind recent events ignored by the corporate media, and provide interviews, reviews, and views that we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. I'm your host today, Lori Mercier, and engineering is Tammy Dean. Today we'll consider the health of the nation, what ails it, and what we can do to help it recover. First, we'll consider the U.S. addiction to violence and militarism and its pathological support for Israel's repression of Palestinians and aggressive actions against Lebanon. I'll be talking to Christopher Hedges, former war correspondent for the New York Times, about the meaning of this aggression. Then the movie mole, Denise Morris, will review the British documentary Death in Gaza. Next, we'll turn to the physical state of Americans and our expensive, flawed healthcare system. Bill Resnick will speak with Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, faculty member of the Harvard Medical School and co-founder of Physicians for National Health Program, about the recent study comparing U.S. to Canadian healthcare systems. At half the cost, Canada provides much better healthcare to all its citizens. What can be done here to institute better quality care for all? Finally, Fran Michel offers a well-read read on Antonio Gramsci and his diagnosis of the intellect and the soul, and how we must keep both finely tuned to analyze and change the world. Well, on the line with me now is Christopher Hedges, the former Middle East Bureau Chief for the New York Times and now a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He's also the author of a very thoughtful book about humanity's love affair with war, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Welcome to KBOO, Chris.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, for almost the past 2 weeks, Israeli airstrikes and assaults on Lebanon have created a humanitarian and foreign policy crisis. With hundreds of civilians dead, thousands wounded, the United Nations has reported that a third of those are children, and at least 500,000 people, and their numbers inevitably growing, are homeless and need assistance. Yet the Bush administration is sending more weapons to Israel, and a resolution giving unconditional support to Israel passed recently, overwhelmingly, in the House and the Senate. Your recent article in the online journal Truth Dig, titled Mutually Assured Destruction in the Middle East, which probably says it all here for us, warns that the Bush administration's support of extremists in Israel is leading the region into a death spiral. What is this escalation of violence in the region likely to achieve?
Well, it's not going to achieve anything positive. I mean, I think that's rather obvious. I mean, I'd like just to go back and say that, you know, this has been a long time coming. The Bush administration, since its inception, you know, over the last 5 years, has never had any interest in helping to broker Middle Eastern peace agreements. And this utter negligence to try and step in and address one of the root causes of instability in the Middle East was seen as befriending Israel, along with you know, these sort of bizarre demands of the Christian right. In fact, the administration only assisted a very extreme militaristic wing within Israel, which since the death of Yitzhak Rabin has done a very effective job in endangering the Jewish state by dismantling, you know, the mechanisms for peace and turning Israel into an international pariah. You know, we're left with a situation in Lebanon where I think we do have to lay much of the blame at the feet of the Bush administration, where these two extreme wings, both within Israel and within you know, the Palestinian and Shiite world speak to each other in one language, which is the language of violence. And that's what we're seeing, that the center has been ripped apart, that those voices within the Arab world, within Israel, within the United States, that are calling for some kind of restraint and compassion and understanding are being drowned out. And these two sides, of course, fuel this collective necrophilia by holding up the corpses of their own. And of course, you know, the more corpses they have, the more the voices of reason are drowned out.
Well, much of what you say seems obvious. It seems common sense that this kind of escalation of violence is only going to lead to this kind of spiraling disaster. But the war ostensibly has to do with captured Israeli soldiers. I mean, what in reality do you think this is about?
Well, it's clear. I mean, first of all, you know, having spent 7 years of my life in the Middle East, there have been many cases where Israel has engaged in long and painful negotiations for the release of captured soldiers. The last prisoner exchange took place in 2004, where Israel traded 400 and some prisoners that they had, most of all of them Lebanese, for the bodies of, I believe it was three of their soldiers who had been killed in an Israeli spy who had been captured. The notion that they never negotiate is just patently untrue. I mean, you know, and people can go back and look at the historical record. Clearly, the capture of the Israeli soldiers, which, you know, was done by Hezbollah to free three of their own leaders who have spent many years in Israeli jails, became an excuse for Israel to try and wipe out the infrastructure of Hezbollah in the south, which does have 12,000 rockets, many of them Katusha rockets, and some long-range rockets. The problem with this strategy, I believe, is that, you know, Hezbollah is a militia. Hezbollah is not a conventional military force. They have these rocket caches sort of stockpiled in wooden crates all over the south, and once they're fired, they move on to another point. I mean, I think that the notion that somehow they're going to crush, that this is going to succeed in crushing Hezbollah as a force, is misguided, and I think that's, of course, why we're seeing Israeli troops now making land incursions into southern Lebanon. But the broader problem is that, of course, the violence that they have unleashed on Lebanon is so hugely disproportionate to the event that occurred and is affecting not only the civilians of Lebanon who are innocents, who have nothing to do with Hezbollah. Many Lebanese can't stand Hezbollah. But also destroying Lebanon itself, destroying the infrastructure of the country. And I think that, you know, enraging the population, you know, playing into Hezbollah's hands, which is what Israel is doing, becomes a very powerful recruitment tool in the hands of Hezbollah. But it also leaving Lebanon itself unstable, especially after it had picked itself up after 16 years of civil war, is not in the long-term interest of Israel. And I think that what we're seeing is essentially, unfortunately, the calcification of leadership, both within Washington and within the Middle East. The power rests in the hands of people who don't understand diplomacy, who don't speak the language of diplomacy, who don't understand the other, who see everyone in their own reflection, i.e. as a nationalist, and as one who believes that force can ultimately solve problems. I mean, the Bush administration has made this disastrous mistake in Iraq, and they have given the green light or allowed Israel to carry out this, I think, ultimately very foolish attack on Lebanon. But I think we have to go back to Washington, because it's very clear that Washington could stop this, if not immediately, certainly within a few hours. And their complicity in this is something that is going to be disastrous, not only for Palestinians, Lebanese, and I think Israelis, but for us as well.
Well, I think that's the critical point to make here. And whether or not this is willful ignorance or intentional on the part of the Bush administration and the right wing in Israel, what could be in the U.S. and Israeli interests to unleash this kind of force? And I'm wondering here by recent remarks by Rush Limbaugh, Newt Gingrich, and others in the right wing in the United States who have been celebrating Israel's action as a gift and cheering on this as possibly World War III. Is this some kind of neoconservative dream to create chaos and see what results from it, rather than a lack of ability to engage in diplomacy?
Well, I wouldn't pin it on neoconservatives. I mean, you know, I think having spent 20 years of my life as a war correspondent, I saw that very dark intoxication that violence has, that kind of allure. The Bible calls it the lust of the eye and warns believers against it, of course. But I think that attraction to violence cuts across political lines. I think what you're seeing is, and of course, remember, none of these people have been in a war. Olmert has not. Bush has not. You know, there is, you know, for those of us who stood on the ground as the bombs have come down, you know, there is a horror to what's happening that is beyond the comprehension of people who have spent their lives in zones of safety and never been in conflict. For them, it's intoxicating. And it's intoxicating because I think there is a direct or there's a feeling of empowerment that they look at those bombs being dropped all over Lebanon. They look at, you know, the destruction in southern Beirut. They look at the warplanes and the ships, and they feel empowered. I mean, I think we saw this at the inception and in the initial stages of the war in Iraq. And that's a very dangerous emotion to unleash, and that's what's been unleashed. So it's not simply, of course, the neoconservatives have signed up, but what you're feeding is a very primal and a very frightening attraction to violence. You know, but war, as I write in my book, at its essence is about death. And when you go to war and you worship violence, you kneel at the feet of the god of death, or the god of Thanatos, as the Greeks would say.
Well, from your examination of the historical evolution of various conflicts and your observations as a war correspondent in different war zones across the world, how does this recent conflagration in Lebanon compare to other conflicts? And what do you see as paralleling those other conflicts, and in what ways does this present new dangers for the Middle East?
Well, it's a very one-sided conflict. You have a very powerful conventional military force essentially, you know, unleashing its might against a country that is virtually defenseless. You know, I think that the notion that somehow there's a kind of equatable balance between the Katyusha rockets that Hezbollah drops on Haifa and the sorties by, you know, F-16 squadrons that are dropping 1,000-pound iron fragmentation bombs, or, you know, the 155 howitzers in northern Israel that are lobbing, you know, shells the size of, small bombs onto villages is equatable, is wrong. I mean, you know, this is really about reoccupation, resubjugation, and not in any way excusing Hezbollah. But the notion that it's a war, I think, is, for those of us who've been in conflicts which are more evenly matched, is farcical. It reminds me very much of the Serbs' attack on the Muslims in Bosnia, a war that I covered, where the Serbs were pounding Sarajevo with 2,000 shells a day, including 90-millimeter tank rounds and Katyusha rockets and 155 howitzers, and the Muslims had virtually nothing to answer back with. I mean, they, you know, the small arms and the tiny mortars, 61 mortars and stuff that they could lob at the Serbs were no comparison. So I think it is a very lopsided conflict, and I would be very careful about using the word war. I think this is, you know, that's not what is happening here. What is happening is essentially the
aggressive attacks by Israel.
It's essentially the pounding and destruction of a country that does not have the wherewithal to defend itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I'm wondering what would be in the U.S. interest to create this kind of chaos and destabilization of Lebanon.
Well, it's not. It's not in the U.S. interest. Unfortunately, we're led by people in this country who are just woefully ignorant of the way the world works, and certainly, you know, the language of war and what war is. I mean, just as the occupation of Iraq is not in our interest, the destruction of Lebanon is not in our interest. There's a kind of frightening, apocalyptic undercurrent to all of this. I think we have, with the Bush administration, and we have to go back and be very clear that, the Clinton administration and other administrations were very partial towards Israel and the peace agreements, but at least they were able to counsel some restraint. Now, anything Israel does is accepted and supported, even when it's not in our interest or in Israel's interest.
So you see this more than just the efforts of the neoconservatives, the Bush administration, and others to create this kind of chaotic destabilization in order to control the last remaining oil supplies in the Middle East?
Well, I think, there isn't any oil to speak of in Lebanon, so I think it's more, what they look at it as sort of the war on terror, and, if we can bomb southern Lebanon back to the Stone Age and disrupt Hezbollah, which controls southern Lebanon, at least south of Tyre, this is, this is a good thing. I think directly tied to control of oil, which is, of course, a huge part of why we're in Iraq, it's more that notion that, we are fighting a broad war on terror. It's this binary view of the world between us and them, where all Muslims sort of become enemies. And of course, I would add a very simplistic and childish view of the world, one that's going to get us and has gotten us into a lot of trouble.
Well, Christopher Hedges, at the end of your piece in Truth Dig, you note that with George W. Bush as our best hope for peace, it's time to run for cover. And I'm sure you don't mean for us to run away from this tragedy, but to do what we can to stop it. And what can we do to halt these insane policies, the occupations of Iraq, Gaza, and the attacks on Lebanon?
I ask myself that question every day. I don't know. Other than stopping to pay taxes, I don't know how to influence these people.
Well, that's pretty bleak, and we try to be a little bit more optimistic on
well,
the old mold variety.
If you think of a good way to get them to wake up, let me know.
Well, I think most immediately people can assist the Lebanese. I know that the American University of Beirut is heading a medical emergency fund.
Yes, certainly in terms of relief, but, how do we get them to begin to understand that they're creating a world that is becoming, on a daily basis, more frightening and more dangerous? That I don't know.
It takes the mobilization of Americans to change these policies.
Well, the more mobilization, the better.
Yeah.
And, the sort of passivity in the face of what we're doing in Iraq, for those of us who spent a lot of time in Iraq, is really depressing.
Yes. Well, thanks very much, Chris Hedges.
Not at all.
Now we'll hear from movie mole Denise Morris reviewing the British documentary Death in Gaza.
Death in Gaza is an Emmy Award-winning documentary film about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and its impact on Palestinian children. Documentary filmmaker James Miller and journalist Cyrus Shah, both British citizens, traveled to Gaza to make a documentary that is, quote, about what it's like to grow up in a conflict zone, end quote. A second separate film was to be made exploring the same question as it relates to Israeli children. That film never was made because, tragically, James Miller was shot to death by an Israeli soldier while filming in Rafah. Miller and Shaw collaborated on the documentary Beneath the Veil. Filmed in late 2000 and early 2001, Beneath the Veil is the story of Cyrus Shah's journey through Afghanistan, a country not yet under international scrutiny. Cyrus, along with James Miller as cameraman, traveled through some major towns and small villages to talk to ordinary people and discover how the Taliban's regime affected their lives. Unholy War is the sequel to Beneath the Veil. Both documentaries were well received and are available on DVD or through the library. Death in Gaza begins and ends on May 2, 2003, the day that James Miller died. In between, we are allowed to look into the lives of Palestinian children caught in a war zone and their, quote, indoctrination into the politics of hate. Death in Gaza's primary subjects are a 12-year-old boy, Ahmed, and his friend, Mohammed. They are like regular kids, except they play games like Jews and Arabs, like we played Cowboys and Indians, except the one that wins dies. We follow the children to school. We see a bit of what they learn, time spent with family, activities with paramilitary resistance fighters, making and using homemade explosives against Israeli occupation forces, and the mourning of the death of friends and family members. All of this in the context of danger, meager resources, and barely inhabitable neighborhoods. Rafah, the primary location of the film, is a town in the Gaza Strip on the Egyptian border. It is the largest town in the southern strip, with a population of about 96,000, of which some 44,000 live in the two refugee camps, Canada Camp to the north and Rafah Camp to the south. After the Israeli War of Independence, the refugee camps were established. And in the summer of 1971, the Israeli Defense Forces, under General Ariel Sharon, destroyed approximately 2,000 houses in the refugee camps of the Gaza Strip, a quarter of them in Rafah. Bulldozers plowed through dense urban areas to create wide patrol roads to facilitate the general mobility of Israeli forces. The demolitions in Rafah displaced nearly 4,000 people. For a deeper look at the history and present circumstances in Rafah, check out the Human Rights Watch website, www.hrw.org. Death is central to the lives of the children we meet in the film. These young people, as we might expect, are wise beyond their years. They are articulate, knowing, and passionate. Boys and girls alike are linked by struggle. And we learn that martyrdom is not just for adults. But it does seem to be more for boys. While girls express a fear of death or a wish to die in order to escape the misery of living under occupation, the boys are more likely to engage in the daily battles. Throwing rocks or homemade explosives at Israeli tanks or bulldozers often results in retaliation by Israeli soldiers. Children die in these battles, and when they die, they become martyrs. The walls of desolate buildings are covered with posters of children and resistance fighters celebrated as martyrs. Narrator Cyrus Shaw observes, quote, "They're outgunned by the Israelis, so they've turned death into victory," end quote. Death in Gaza succeeds in giving us a glimpse of the tragic, deep-seated rage and hatred Palestinian children live with in the earliest years of their development. But the film fails to give us a tangible context for truly understanding why. Filmmakers Shaw and Miller lay claim to journalism's golden rule, "Thou shalt be objective." The key question the filmmakers wish to address is, quote, "What would cause someone to hate so much that they are willing to die in order to kill?" end quote. In the first moments of the film, Shaw claims, "This film isn't about the rights and wrongs of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It is about the people who get sucked in," end quote. When asked by an interviewer what she would like viewers to take away from this film, Shaw replies, "These kids are not monsters. They live in unacceptable conditions. Human beings are human beings the world over, and the circumstances they live in have a profound impact on their behavior," end quote. The stated intentions seem clear. The footage is incredible, moving, and stunning. But with the death of James Miller, Shaw is on her own to create the story that becomes the film, and she proves again that objectivity is an illusion. This film is framed in the opening text before we even see a single image. Providing little historical context, we are told Israeli citizens have been subjected to wave after wave of deadly terror attacks by Palestinian militants, end quote. Minutes later, we are reminded that Israel acts in self-defense against these terror attacks. In fact, militants and extremists are the adjectives of choice when characterizing Palestinians. The film also has a sinister tone at times, depicting masked men in dark alleyways, painting propaganda on the walls of bombed-out buildings, indoctrinating children, as if the conditions of resistance are not clear and present. It is never considered that Israel has acted out of aggression. Shaw has spoken about being horrified by what she terms the lack of respect for human life on the part of the Israeli soldiers, but this is not made clear in the film. The voices of Palestinian children could benefit from having this articulated as a distinct possibility. Otherwise, their claims to resistance are too easily framed as terrorism. Shaw and Miller didn't want to get into politics or history. They believed the images could tell the story. They do tell a story, an important one, but Shaw's bias frames the images, creating a new conflict, that of years of Western assumption and the willingness to accept, unconditionally, that Palestinians have no claim to self-defense against the most heavily armed and well-funded military in the region. Yet, this ideological lens runs counter to the images screaming to break free and tell a different story, a story of self-defense, of reclamation and liberation, with a desire to become three-dimensional outside the bounds of narrow and vilified agents of terror. History is nearly absent. Power structures and their agents are not distinguished from the general population, but the passion and desperation of an occupied people is clear. I do recommend this film, but I have a suggestion. Watch it with no sound, eliminate the narrator, and do not read the opening text. Just take it in. Let the images and the kids do the talking. This is, after all, what the filmmakers intended. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking about the film Death in Gaza.
I fled my village. The Stern gang drove my family from the lands. We ran into the desert, where I've spent these decades living by my hands. Life in Haifa wasn't easy, but so much better than this hellhole with the soldiers and barbed wire and the closures and the hunger. Humiliation and the checkpoints, the machine gun fired. Each day I wonder, after Haifa, the home that we abandoned when the Zionists had won, is there a family with a child? Does its father love it as I loved my only son? Before the soldiers shot him down, riddled him with bullets in his back and in his head, home in Haifa. In my house, does his father know the pain there is in an empty bed?
Steffi Wohlhandler, welcome to KABU here in Portland, Oregon.
Happy to be here.
Steffi Wohlhandler teaches at the Harvard Medical School. She's a founder and board member of Physicians for a National Health Program. Steffi Wohlhandler, a number of recent studies of the U.S. healthcare system, the results have been really shocking. Tell us about it.
Well, our own study that's coming out in July 2006, American Journal of Public Health, compared Americans to Canadians. We looked at how healthy people were and how well the healthcare system functioned. And on both accounts, Canadians did much better than Americans. That is, Canadians had less of every chronic disease that was asked about. They had less diabetes, less high blood pressure, less asthma, less lung disease. But in addition, Canadians found it much easier to get access to medical care. They were more likely to have a regular doctor, less likely to say they needed health care but couldn't get it, much less likely to say that they needed a drug or a pharmaceutical that they couldn't get. So our study showed Americans are less healthy than Canadians, and they have worse access to medical care. This, despite the fact that we in the United States spend nearly twice as much per capita on health care as they spend in Canada.
And the English study that was released about a month ago finds quite similar findings, very different study.
Yes, absolutely. That study appeared in the JAMA. It was done by other authors, but they found something very similar. They found that Americans were less healthy than people in Britain, and they had very detailed measurements, blood tests, and they were able to document that Americans are much sicker and have worse health overall than people in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm. The English study, the comparison, was done with, what, basically white middle-class people in both countries. Is that?
Well, they were able to look at if you did comparisons where you controlled for income, controlled for race, controlled for insurance coverage in the United States. Of course, everyone in Britain has insurance coverage. So they were able to control for all those things, and they still found that even after control for those other factors, and taking those other factors into account, Americans were less healthy than British people.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the access part. The attack in the United States on the Canadian system and also the English systems was that, oh, they have these horrible long waiting lists. You can just die with a heart problem on the waiting list. What's the real story about that?
Well, there are some waits in Canada. They're relatively modest. In our study, about 3% of Canadians said that they couldn't get medical care because of long waits, and less than 1% of Americans said they couldn't get medical care because of long waits. So there was some evidence that waits were a problem in Canada, though the problem affected a small number of people, only 3% of the population. I just want to remind you that Canada is spending just about half of what we are on a per capita basis, and I would say to my Canadian friends that if you don't like the waiting list, then you need to spend a little bit more money. But overall, their system performed at a better level than the U.S. system, despite the very low levels of spending in Canada.
Mm-hmm. You know, the waiting list thing, I have a friend who's waiting for I wait a long time to get an appointment at Kaiser, just to get an appointment, to see anybody, to walk in. Is that considered a wait? I had the sense that Americans don't recognize how long they're asked to wait because it's because the bureaucracy records things very differently.
Well, certainly Americans do wait for care. When my daughter needed knee surgery to get the surgeon she wanted, was a 3-month wait. So you can wait in the United States, and in our study, just under 1% of Americans had been unable to get care because the wait was just too long, but it was up more than 3% of Canadians. So there's waits in both countries. I don't think waits are a good thing. I think if the Canadians want to get rid of their waits, they'll have to spend a little bit more money. But I do want to remind you that waits in Canada are only for elective procedures. Nobody waits for things like cancer surgery. Nobody waits for urgent heart surgery. Those things are provided on an urgent basis, just as they would be in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And for those, 50 million people who don't have insurance here or who are in slow HMOs or whatever, it's not only where they are denied care, the wait can be forever, right? They don't even try and get on a waiting list, and they allow their health to keep deteriorating.
Well, I think that's certainly true in for the uninsured. It's also true for many people who just have partial coverage. They may have some insurance, but it's so full of gaps like copayments and deductibles and uncovered services that they simply can't afford the care they need. Some of the HMOs in this country are quite good, as you know, but many of them are very restrictive and throw a lot of barriers between the patients and the care they need.
Mm-hmm. The access to medical care. Let's talk about why the why is it why Americans are also, it seems to me, dying earlier. It's not only do they have more chronic diseases than in other countries that spend a lot less on health care, but the life expectancy here is appreciably less.
Absolutely. Americans live 2 to 3 years shorter lives than Canadians. Canadians get to live longer. That's not from our study, but that's from the vital statistics agencies of the two countries. And we've known that for some time, that Canadians do live longer than Americans. So I guess we shouldn't have been surprised to find out that Canadians also have less of chronic diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure.
Right. It seems to me economic class, social and economic class make a big difference. People with money live much longer than people without money.
Well, it's definitely true in the United States in particular, but all over the world, that low-income people have higher death rates. But one of the things that was interesting is that the degree of inequality between high-income and low-income people in terms of health was much less in Canada. So whereas in Canada, a very low-income person was about 70% more likely to have a problem getting access to care than a high-income people, in the United States, they were nearly 2.5 times more likely to have a problem getting access to care. So, yes, there's inequalities based on income, but when you have a national health insurance system, you're able to reduce those inequalities.
Mm-hmm. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Steffi Woolhandler. She teaches at the Harvard Medical School and is a founder and now board member of Secretary of Physicians for National Health Program. Before we get into the, we've been talking about the recent studies. In fact, another study that I'd like to ask you about just fairly briefly, which is also equally shocking, it seems to me, is the unnecessary deaths in hospitals that came out a couple of years ago. It's it appears that 100,000 people a year are dying in the United States unnecessarily. Some of whom would die in a month or two anyway, but I don't know. I take that back. But some of them are quite sick. But there's so many mistakes.
Of course, if a month or two is a lot of time, if that's all the time you've got.
Right.
So we take any unnecessary death very seriously, even if it only shortens life by a month or two.
Right.
And I'm sure you do too.
Yes. I mean, there's many are older people whose life expectancy is not great, but there are just enormous numbers of mistakes in hospitals. Many are quite healthy people who come in with something fairly minor, and they go out as a corpse. What do you make of that? I mean, it seems part of the picture of a medical system with immense amounts of technology, spending huge amounts of money, but providing very poor levels of real health care.
Well, there's been a major effort to reduce medical errors in hospitals. I know the hospital where I work, there's a lot of quality assurance work. We've got special nurses looking into errors, trying to investigate what went wrong. There's a lot of what we call latent errors, where you make a mistake, nobody's hurt, but you want to fix the problem before somebody does get hurt. So we and many other hospitals and health systems have been putting a tremendous amount of energy into trying to eliminate those errors, and I agree with you completely. It's shocking. It's intolerable. And the doctors, the hospitals, the entire healthcare system needs to focus on reducing those errors.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to the not just the errors, but the very high rates in the United States, despite all the money spent of chronic disease and the lower life expectancy. Why is that? How do you understand that?
Well, I think there's two problems. Both Canada and the United States need to clean up their lifestyles. We need to live more healthy lives. We need to exercise more. We need to eat smaller portions. We did find that Americans were more sedentary than Canadians, so we need to really work on that. We did, however, find that Canadians were more likely to smoke than Americans, and I think Canada really needs to work on reducing smoking, because sedentary lifestyle and smoking are two major causes of ill health, two major causes of disease. But I think the evidence from our study is that at least part of the difference is related to access to medical care, that Canadians uniformly have access to primary and preventive care. Any Canadian can take their national health insurance card, go to any doctor in all of Canada, get primary preventive care absolutely free, not have to worry about any copayments or deductibles. So that's a situation that facilitates the early identification of disease, the early identification of risk for disease, when it's relatively easy to intervene and try to delay the disease from coming.
Mm-hmm. What about the sort of the organization of the health system and the ways the all of the people in the health system operate and what they concentrate on. Is healthcare, it could be quite subtle, but is there a way in which a national healthcare system, it seems to me it could, surely, create a more cooperative relationship amongst many of the caregivers, would bring people in more, would spend more time on educating people and helping them and giving them the skills for dealing with chronic diseases, like diabetes. If it's out of control in the United States, care is really poor, and yet it can be controlled if people get enough support and enough and learn the skills for controlling it. Would it, in Canada and, in fact, in England, do they do a better job?
Well, the one thing, big difference we know about is that in the United States, we have to spend much more of our time on billing and healthcare paperwork. So the doctors, the nurses, the receptionists are really focused on figuring out what insurance you have, how the bill's going to get paid. That is just not an issue in Canada. Every Canadian has the National Health Insurance Plan. The doctors and hospitals know they're going to get paid. It's a simple system that doesn't involve much in the way of paperwork. About half of the total cost difference between the U.S. and Canada is accounted for by the difference in healthcare paperwork. So by simplifying the payment structure in the U.S., going to a simple single-payer national health insurance system, we could save perhaps $300 billion a year just on paperwork, use that money to improve care for the uninsured, but also to do the kinds of things that you're talking about, develop cooperative ways of working with patients to maintain their health when they get diabetes or high blood pressure, one of these chronic diseases that is controllable and which we can prevent complications, but we've got to work very closely with the patients.
Mm-hmm. You were suggesting something else. It's true. I've gone in with friends to emergency rooms, and my sense is, first it takes a long time for people to give them their insurance coverage, and then it's checked and all the rest of the stuff. And by the time all the forms and stuff is filled out and the people are ready to be seen, I had the sense that some of the people within the in the apparatus there almost felt as if their job was done. That, in fact, it was such an ordeal to get it all together that, in fact, by the time, you know, there was a sort of a sigh of relief, as if the real task was, in fact, making sure that they could bill the person.
Yeah. Well, maybe the sigh of relief is they've gotten over the unpleasant, alienating part of the job, and they could get on to the fun part, which, of course, is listening to patients and seeing their patients. But certainly in the financial sense, we're putting a tremendous amount of resources into healthcare billing, administration, healthcare paperwork, resources that we ought to be spending to improve care for patients.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the time of some of the people in the system just gets devoted to the forums and everything. And the
well, according to surveys, American physicians spend about 13% of their work day on administration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, probably about half of that you'd have to do anyway, whether there were billing issues or not, because you do have to keep track of things. But a large part of the time that doctors devote to paperwork in their day relates to our complicated private insurance-oriented system where doctors have to deal with literally hundreds of different insurance plans in a small practice.
Mm-hmm. This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Steffi Wohlhandler, founder and board member of Physicians for a National Health Program. Steffi Wohlhandler, tell us about briefly, Physicians for a National Health Program, and on how do people learn about you? I've looked at the website that has articles and op-eds that you've done.
Well, we really recommend people go to our website. It's www.pnhp.org, or you can just Google Physicians for a National Health Program. But the website is our initials, PNHP. It's full of articles, video clips, press releases, information about activities in your own area. We recommend We're obviously interested in physicians going to our website and joining, but people are welcome to come and just seek information, educate yourself, and find out about the issues.
Mm-hmm. Your major constituency, your major membership is physicians, I gather, or people in the healthcare system.
It's mostly physicians. It's more than 95% physicians. We do offer full membership to other health professionals, nurses, pharmacists, if they're interested. And we're really thrilled to have them on board, but most of the membership is physicians.
Why would physicians be interested in national health care when it's, my guess is that the entrepreneurial physician or even physician's wages and all of the rest of it is probably somewhat greater in the United States than it is in Canada, the average salary, or is that wrong?
Well, the salaries in Canada are quite good. On average, they're a little lower than physician salaries in the United States, but physicians don't have to do all that billing paperwork. They don't have to worry if they're going to get paid. They don't have to, worry about the keeping track of every Band-Aid and penicillin shot and knowing who to bill it to. There's just a whole lot more flexibility in the doctor's work life because you're not dealing with payment all the time. I think the biggest motivator, though, is that, we doctors really don't like it when we see someone who's sick and we can't get them the care that they need. When you have a sick patient who needs something, you want to take care of them. And we at our hospital had a young house painter who, in his 20s, who had a serious cardiac problem and needed a heart transplant, didn't have any way to pay for it, and there was just no way for us to get that for him, so he's dead. And we hated that. We hated seeing that happen. We talked about it a very great deal, and we as doctors feel we really need to be able to get patients the care that they need, and that's why so many doctors have joined Physicians for National Health Program, because they're finding they just can't take care of their patients.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to suggest that the motives for, in fact, I wanted to really talk about the opposite. People's motives aren't, in fact, just financial and pecuniary. It seems to me that another reason that physicians might be interested, again, is that the opportunity to actually restructure their practice a little bit to have more collaborative relationships with a whole host of other specialties of various kinds of preventive programs. Is that also possible? Is it difficult now for doctors, for physicians, and for the primary care people to access these other services because of all of the intermediaries?
Well, absolutely. There's major problems. You may have seen a series of articles in the New York Times about diabetes, but they brought up the issue that a hospital gets paid a lot of money to cut off someone's foot. But the money to treat their diabetes with diet and exercise, to educate people about diabetes, the kinds of primary care practices that would have prevented the diabetic from losing the foot in the first place, those, there's just not money. There's not really reimbursement to make that happen. So many New York City hospitals have closed down the special clinics they had for diabetes to help them lose weight and exercise. But none of them have closed down the parts of the hospital that, do the amputations when people don't get the care they need for the diabetes. So we do have a system that rewards the late interventions, the very unpleasant interventions that can occur late in disease if you don't take good care of yourself. But there's just not the funding, not the money there to provide that early preventive care that could prevent the complication.
Steffi Wohlhandler, thanks a lot. Again, if you Google PNHP, you get Physicians for a National Health Program. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
Right. So long.
That was Ann Feeney from her CD, Union Made. And before we listened to that bit of music, we heard Bill Resnick talking with Steffi Woolhandler of Physicians for National Healthcare. Up next, Fran Michel and A Well-Read Red on Antonio Gramsci.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with The Well-Read Red. I've been thinking lately of the motto often cited by the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, to the effect that what leftists require is pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. We need to recognize the potentially daunting complexity and power of the situation we are working to change, and yet remain undaunted about the possibility of changing it. Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, was a perspective Gramsci had reason to know something about. Born in Italy in 1891, Gramsci, spelled G-R-A-M-S-C-I, grew up poor but won a scholarship to the University of Turin, where he developed his interest in socialism. He lived through the success of the Russian Revolution in 1917 and the failure of the like to happen in the rest of Europe. Co-founder of the Italian Communist Party in 1921, Gramsci saw the rise to power in Italy of Mussolini's fascism, and when Mussolini outlawed the Communist Party in 1926, Gramsci spent most of the last 11 years of his life in prison. The writing he did there, before his death in 1937, came to light only many years later, but Gramsci's prison notebooks have been an important resource for those seeking to understand the persistence of capitalism, the rise of fascism, and the possibilities of socialism. Gramsci's reexaminations of Marx emphasized that changing socioeconomic circumstances do not, of themselves, produce political changes. Gramsci resisted dogmatic or abstract conceptions of Marxism and simplistic notions of the economic base determining the social or cultural superstructure. Instead, he emphasized the creativity of everyday culture, the intellectual capacities of all people, the importance of ideology and ideological struggle in creating political alliances, and the contradictions existing in every historical moment. In his essay on The Study of Philosophy, which appears in the prison notebooks and is available on the Marxist Internet Archive, marxist.org, Gramsci observes, quote, "It is essential to destroy the widespread prejudice that philosophy is a strange